Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Roman Baratiak. I'm the Associate Director at the UCSB Arts and Lectures Program. And we are thrilled and delighted that Mary Roach is here with us this evening. She was enduring life in the void at San Francisco Airport this afternoon and was delayed by about 5 hours. But we're delighted that she's here with us. Again, our typical format, Mary will give her lecture. We'll follow that with your questions. Tonight we're going to, because we have a more intimate crowd, if you have a question, just raise your hand and then stand and ask your question. Mary will repeat it so that we can catch it on our UCTV coverage. And then we'll do a book signing right up here on the stage. If you didn't notice, there are copies of Mary's books available in the lobby, courtesy of Borders. Also, if there are students here in the audience, Mary was going to visit a seminar session at the College of Creative Studies, which unfortunately didn't happen because of the plane delay. So we want to invite all UCSB students to come out tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. to the College of Creative Studies, and Mary will be doing a post-lecture conversation with you. Should be great fun and a really terrific opportunity to meet really probably the funniest science writer in the country. So again, 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at the College of Creative Studies. And as I just mentioned, Mary Roach has been called the funniest science writer in the country and a writer with stand-up comic timing. A best-selling author, her previous books include Stiff, The Curious Life of Human Cadavers, Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, and her latest, the critically acclaimed book, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Please welcome to the stage Mary Roach.
Just going to have a sip of water here. I'm delighted that there's water and not Tang, because my publicist got this idea that it'd be really funny to like have Tang at all of the readings and all the events that I've gone to. So for the first week, I was like dutifully drinking Tang, and then I began to worry that my bladder was fluorescent, so I'm drinking water now. Tang is actually not a NASA invention. People think that NASA invented Tang, but it's actually one of those off-the-shelf products, and NASA does a lot of those. They don't invent everything that they need, including the diapers that the astronauts wear. At one point, I asked the Public Affairs Office about this, and we got into a conversation. I don't know what brand they're using now, but for a while they were using a brand of adult diaper called Rejoice. Who names an adult diaper? I mean, it's a very optimistic approach to the adult diaper, I felt. Anyway, I've written this book, Packing for Mars, and it's not a typical space book. I don't know that there really is a typical space book, but I think of them as kind of a lot of heroics and bravery, you know, people sort of boldly going and boldly coming back, and, you know, you have Commander Lovell and Apollo 13 fighting for their lives, you know, and there's an explosion on the way to the moon, and a lot of dramatics. I did interview Jim Lovell, but not about Apollo 13. I interviewed him about Gemini 7. Gemini 7 was kind of a dress rehearsal for the moon. It was the longest flight we'd done to date. It was 2 weeks, and up to that point, it had been 2 or 3 days in space. And one of the things they were trying to get at with this, one of the questions they were answering was, what happens to a human being when they don't bathe for 2 weeks and they're wearing a spacesuit 24/7? Is this just too hideous a thing to put people through? Is it just too, does their skin start to fall off? I mean, do they stink too badly? Will they be able to stand it? This chapter in my book is called Houston, We Have a Fungus. And there's this memorable point in the mission transcript where the flight surgeons were very involved in this flight. It was like they'd get on the line and at one point they actually said, Gemini 7, this is flight surgeon. Have you had any dandruff problem up there, Frank? This is Frank Borman, Commander Frank Borman. I mean, and dandruff, not a word you expect to find in a mission transcript. Also, lotion, the word lotion, you know, because you go through these transcripts, they're very technical, and then all of a sudden it'll be just like how are your skins? You know, and Frank Borman would just refuse to answer. It was like it was compromising the overall manliness of the mission to be. And you had to feel bad for them, partly because one of the things that happens when you don't bathe for 2 weeks, you know, your skin exfoliates, and normally those skin cells would be washed away down the shower drain. Well, that doesn't happen. They tend to build up and clump, and you have dandruff. And in zero gravity, the dandruff doesn't fall to your shoulders. It doesn't fall to the floor. It floats. I actually asked Jim Lovell about this. I believe my exact words were, was it just like a snow globe in there? He said, Mary, you're investigating a rather unusual aspect of spaceflight. So anyway, the book was about the astronaut life, but it's also about sort of space on Earth, this very surreal world of simulated space travel, because space is this incredibly hostile, foreign, bizarre place where it just nothing works like it works on Earth. You take away gravity and it just sort of everything gets turned on its head. So because it is so weird and foreign and expensive, everything gets simulated here on Earth, which sort of enables someone like me to go into space without ever leaving the ground, which is kind of what I did for the book. And there are just these, some of the simulations are really very entertaining. By way of example, the space toilet. This is, you may not really appreciate gravity in your lives the way you should. The toilet on Earth, this your standard toilet, it you need gravity. Gravity is what gives you, in the parlance of the NASA Waste Management Systems Department, good separation. Okay, because you sit down, I mean, it is, you know, you have this material, this growing mass, you know, more mass, more gravitational pull, and it's it's gravity that gives you the plop. Yeah, no gravity, no place. Stuff just kind of hovers, and that is that's a tricky thing because in space you've got to figure out in zero gravity you've got to come up with another way. So you don't have gravity, you've got to move that material along. So they use airflow. You're essentially sitting on a shop vac basically, and it's air drag that is pulling the material along. Well, how much air drag, how much airflow is enough, and how much is too much? You get too much, then you're kind of like, you know, you got this suction injuries going on. So you got to haul this whole thing, and it is like almost, I'm not exaggerating, the size of this podium. It's great big, like washing machine size thing. You've got to test it, and you want to be able to test it in zero gravity. Okay, that means hauling it over to Ellington Field and putting it on a weightless flight. It's a parabolic flight, it's called, and it's this plane that doesn't go into space. It goes up out over the Gulf of Mexico and flies like this. And as it goes over and down, you have about 22 seconds of zero gravity. So you're testing a toilet. Think about this. Maybe not too hard. it's a challenge. I mean, a lot of people, you could time your watch by their sphincter. You really don't, I mean, you don't have a lot of leeway. You can't just sort of go on demand. So, and I talked to a guy who's a retired food scientist for NASA, and he had been on one of the flights where they were testing the toilet. And he said, he had this wonderful description. He's like, he's there. He was testing a bunch of foods, you know, like 22 different foods, making sure the packaging was right, that stuff didn't float off the spoon or whatever it was. So he's sitting there, and there's a curtain, and he could kind of see, like, as they go over the top and down, he can see the toilet start to rise, and he hears them going, like, go, 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 go! And the guy failed. He failed to produce. And this is incredibly expensive. You wonder why NASA toilets are so expensive. Because you're having to factor in all the zero-gravity testing and all that. And this is the reason why there's a department over at NASA Ames, out in my state in California. There are engineers whose job was to come up with an incredibly high-fidelity fecal simulant. Just the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, the stuff that you don't hear about to get, you know, people able to live in this incredibly hostile, weird place called space. It's utterly bizarre and fascinating. So that was sort of where I found myself for a couple of years. What else was going to... Okay, I don't know. I sometimes think that, you know, that I give people the impression that this is an entire book about crapping in space, and it's not. Really, honest to God, it's not. But I just said there's one more thing I have to tell you. I was going to say, even like it keeps going. Even after you test your toilet, you haul it over to Ellington Field, and you do all these tests, and you figure out, yes, we have enough airflow. This thing's going to work. Okay, well, there's always the unexpected. What happened with the toilet, with the shuttle, or a previous incarnation of the shuttle toilet? Okay, one of the way that they sterilized the stuff, the word that they use, the contributions. The way they sterilize the contributions, you just basically expose it to the vacuum of space. Frozen, freeze-dried, boom. Works very well. But what was happening was that the material in the toilet, when it froze, it became very hard, and little bits and pieces were breaking off. And you had this phenomenon called, and this is the words of an engineer at Johnson Space Center, fecal popcorning. Because remember, this is an airflow toilet. You have a stream of air, you know, pretty active, high velocity air, and this material is breaking off, and it's like flying around, like in a popcorn popper. And every now and then, it makes its way to the side. It kind of goes up, and you have an escapee. And so that's why the space shuttle toilet to this day has a rear view mirror. So you make sure that as you float away, nobody's coming with you. So that's enough for toilets for now. the other thing I thought I would talk a little bit about, the psychology of being in space, in a spacecraft, in a little tiny room, lots of people. You can't run out, slam the door, go for a drive. You are soaking in it. It's a very frustrating environment for that reason. You can't really control things. You're stuck. Frustration tends to morph into anger. You got a lot of sort of anger building up, and anger wants an outlet. It wants a place to download. And when you're in space, you don't take it out on your crewmates because that just makes the situation worse. You can't flame them and then run out and escape the situation. You're stuck with them, so you tend not to take it out on your fellow astronauts. Also, you depend on these people for your survival. You really don't want to alienate them. The other thing that you can do with your anger is psychologists call it displacement. You take it out on somebody distant. And in the case of astronauts, it tends to be mission control. In the case of in Gemini 7, and I read that whole, it's like a 400-page transcript of that mission, and you could see what was going on because Jim Lovell, for him, the displacement was happening. He was taking it out on the space food scientist, the nutritionist. Because you'd hear, you'd be reading along, and then you'd see Jim Lovell out of nowhere going, note to Dr. Chance, his name was Dr. Chance, chicken a la king, serial number 6457, cannot even get material through nozzle. And then 2 minutes later, further memo to Dr. Chance, chicken a la king all over window at this time. At $300 a meal, I think you can do better. Just like you could tell, he's got to take it out on someone. He can't take it out on Frank Borman. This is he depends on this guy for his survival. The third thing you can do with your anger in space is turn it inward. And that's something that NASA folks, space flight surgeons worry about, because when you turn anger inward, you get depression. And I spent some time in Star City over in outside Moscow, where they train cosmonauts. And I set up an interview with these two cosmonauts who had spent time on Mir, and the rumor was, what I had heard, was that they really didn't get along well. They were really, a lot of bickering and not speaking to each other. And one of them worked in the Museum of Cosmonautics, and I thought, and they have this mock-up of the Mir living module, and I thought, I'll get the two of them in the mock-up of Mir, and it'll bring back memories, and it'll be really interesting to interview them. So I got them in there. Apparently, they've worked out their differences. They were big bear hug. They're really happy to see each other. But anyway, so I spoke to them for a while, and one of them, the one who was lower ranked, who couldn't really take it out on anybody, but he turned it inward. And I said, his name was Alexander Levake, and I said, did you get depressed in space? Was that a problem for you? He said, Mary, I got so depressed. There were times when I wanted to hang myself. But it's zero gravity. And you can't. I thought, to me, sums up space. What a surreal place. Yeah, anyway. So I'm gonna read a section to you just because it's kind of a fun section, and then I'll talk a little bit more about some various stuff, and I like to leave a lot of time for questions because people have really interesting questions about life in space. So, but let me read you a section. Okay, this is Apollo 16. We're on the moon here. We have Charlie Duke and John Young, and they've been out and about collecting rocks, doing their thing, and now they're back in the lunar module and doing a debriefing with mission control. And out of the blue, Young declares, "I got the farts again. I got them again, Charlie. I don't know what the hell gives them to me. I think it's acid in the stomach." Following Apollo 15, in which low potassium levels were blamed for heart arrhythmias in the crew, NASA had put potassium-laced orange, grapefruit, and other citrus drinks on the menu. Tang. Young kept going. It's all there in the mission transcript. "I mean, I haven't eaten this much citrus fruit in 20 years. And I'll tell you one thing, in another 12 fucking days, I ain't never eaten any more. And if they offer to serve me potassium with my breakfast, I'm going to throw up. I like an occasional orange. I really do. But I'll be damned if I'm going to be buried in oranges." Moments later, Mission Control comes on the line and provides Young with yet more fodder for indigestion. "Orion, this is Houston." "Yes, sir." "Okay, you have a hot mic." "Oh, how long have we had that?" "Okay, that's been on through the whole debriefing." The day after Young's comments hit the press, the governor of Florida issued a statement in defense of his state's key crop, which Charlie Duke paraphrases in his memoir. "It is not our orange juice that is causing the trouble. It is an artificial substitute that does not come from Florida." In fact, it was the potassium, not the orange juice. The, quote, "coefficient of flatulence for orange juice," to use the terminology of USDA flatus researcher Edwin Murphy, a panelist on the 1964 conference in nutrition in space and related waste problems, "is low." Murphy reported on research he had done using an experimental bean meal fed to volunteers who had been rigged via a rectal catheter to outguess into a measurement device. Murphy was interested in individual differences, not just in the overall volume of flatus, but in the differing percentages of constituent gases. Owing to differences in intestinal bacteria, half the population produces no methane. This makes them attractive as astronauts. But not because methane stinks, it is odorless. And here we have a footnote. If you are among the 50% of the population who produce methane, you can play human pilot light. Your friends can hold a match to your gas and watch it ignite and turn blue. Okay. Murphy had a unique... highly flammable, yes. Murphy had a unique suggestion for the NASA Astronaut Selection Committee. Quote, "The astronaut may be selected from that part of our population providing little or no methane or hydrogen being also explosive, and a very low level of hydrogen sulfide and other malodorous trace flatus constituents not yet identified." In other words, this man wanted NASA to select astronauts based on what came out of their asshole. It was a really kind of an incredible... they did not do this. They took the simpler and more rational approach was simply to avoid your high coefficient of flatulence foods. Up through Apollo, beans, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and broccoli were blacklisted. Beans were not reinstated until the shuttle era. There were those who welcomed their arrival, and not just because they're tasty. The zero gravity fart has been a popular orbital pursuit. Particularly on all-male flights. One hears tell of astronauts using intestinal gas like rocket propellant to, quote, "launch themselves across the mid-deck." As astronaut Roger Crouch put it, Crouch had heard these claims and was dubious. "The mass and velocity of the expelled gas," he told me in an email that has forevermore endeared him to me, "is very small compared to the mass of the human body. Thus, it was unlikely that it could accelerate a 180-pound astronaut. Crouch pointed out that an exhaled breath does not propel an astronaut in any direction, and the lungs hold about 6 liters of air, versus the fart, which, as we learned from Dr. Murphy, holds at most 3 soda cans worth, or the average person's, anyway. This is another quote from astronaut Crouch. Excuse me. My genes have blessed me with an extraordinary ability to expel some of the byproducts of digestion. So given that, I thought that this should be tested in space. In what I thought was a real voluminous and rapidly expelled purge, I failed to move noticeably. Crouch surmised that his experiment may have been compromised by the, quote, action reaction of the gas passing through the pants. Disappointingly, both his flights were mixed gender, so Crouch was disinclined to, quote, strip down naked and try it again. He was heading to Cape Canaveral and promised to ask around for some other astronauts' input, but so far no one is, as they say, spilling the beans. Anyway, that's my little reading for this evening. But now, let's see, what else was I going to... Another thing I was going to talk about was... Well, I was just going to talk a little bit more about how the lack of gravity. Really, I never really gave a lot of thought. To me, gravity was just sort of this minor annoyance, you know, things breaking, body parts sagging. I don't know, you don't really give a lot of thought to gravity. But in space, when you take it away, nothing works. I mean, really, you name a body part. In space, okay, here's an example. The human stomach. There was this whole period of time where Coke and Pepsi were determined to have carbonated beverages in space. Well, carbonation is tricky because the little bubbles that normally rise to the surface because they're lighter. Well, in space, everything weighs the same, so they kind of froth around in the middle and you just have this mess and it doesn't work. Well, they actually spent something like $500,000, came up with a zero-gravity carbonation system, did not take into account what goes on in the human stomach, and that is that when you put Coca-Cola into the stomach, the little bubbles don't rise to the top. The top is where the opening is, and when you burp, you know, the gas is conveniently at the top and it comes out. Well, when you burp in zero gravity, you get it's accompanied by a liquid spray, is the way it was put. So the astronauts are like, you're sort of feeling bloated and like unable to burp in a cleanly and inobtrusive way. And just nobody went near it. The bladder, same kind of thing. The bladder, human bladder works via stretch receptors. So you got this liquid that's building up in the bottom. The stretch receptors start to stretch. It tells the brain, time to go to the ladies' room. Well, that doesn't happen because the material, the liquid is clinging by surface tension all around the sides of the sphere of the organ. So you don't, by the time your signal, by your brain tells you it's time to go, it's almost full and you may have like a sort of emergency because the urethra is pressed shut and you may have to get out the self-catheterization kit, and it's at least simple things like that. So there's actually, if you're an astronaut, you are toilet trained. You have to, I mean, you take these guys who are top of their class, incredibly high-achieving individuals, just, you know, motivated, intelligent, and you're putting them back in preschool. They're learning how to go to the bathroom. They're learning how to move, how to cross a room, how to eat, how to use the toilet. It's really kind of extraordinary. So they actually counsel them, you know, like you'd say to a small child on a car trip, you're like, go to the bathroom even if you don't have to. So they're actually relearning everything. There's even... you have to learn how to use the toilet because we're back with the toilets. It's a very small opening, and you're not really sitting. You're sort of hovering in close proximity, and it's hard to get a tactile sense of where you're at. And so because of that, there's this, it's called a positional trainer. It's a toilet with a video camera pointing up. So you, and there's a, it's a closed circuit TV, and the TV screen is right there on your right. You flip a switch, which turns the light on in the toilet, and you have this view of yourself that you have never had and don't ever, ever want to have again. The guy who does the toilet training said, you know, I leave them in here and I show them how to use it, but I think most of them, they don't want to see themselves. Anyway, so yeah, body parts. What else? What else about? Yeah, you get when the what happens in zero gravity? normally a lot of the fluid will kind of fall naturally, you know, your blood, your body fluid falls toward your feet. And in zero gravity, it doesn't do that. So you've got a bigger load on the upper half of your body. And the blood volume sensors are up in the upper half only. So you shed, you know, you lose a lot of water weight. One of the astronauts described it as the space beauty treatment because you lose weight. You've got more fluid up here, so your wrinkles are plumped out. You've got zero gravity, so your body parts are not sagging. You got a lot of buoyancy. Your hair is fuller. Your organs float up under your rib cage, so your waist is smaller. On the other side of that, though, I have heard this described as puffy face chicken leg syndrome. So it's kind of a not sure how attractive it really is. Here's something interesting on the whole fluid shift. There's a memoir by an astronaut named Mike Mullane. It's actually a very readable and very candid space memoir. I recommend it. And Mike Mullane had this passage where he talked about, wow, you know, I had these really intense erections. I could have drilled through kryptonite. And I was thinking like, wow, you know, I heard this rumor, Buzz Aldrin apparently, someone at NASA said that Buzz Aldrin and some of the Apollo guys had commented on the fact that there wasn't a lot of activity down there. And so I sort of thought, well, what is going on? I interviewed one of the Johnson Space Center human factors physiologists. I said, okay, so who's right? Who's wrong? And he said, well, actually, he actually had an answer. This is what I love about scientists. The guy had an answer. Right around the diaphragm, this is the line of orthostatic indifference, I believe it is. And above this line, you've got more fluid, and below it, you have less. And as he put it, the male jumblies would be below that line. So you're talking about a little less intensity down there. So even that is affected. let's see, what else here? I spent some time debunking some common space myths. One of them was this story that you would hear even astronauts in their oral history talk about this, that if you know, when you're out on a spacewalk, you know, and that's when you're wearing the pressure suit, that big, huge, white marshmallow suit, and if you were nauseous, and you are nauseous in space in the first few days, if you happen to throw up in your helmet, that this would be a lethal scenario, because in zero gravity, as I mentioned before, you've got, like, surface tension, stuff clings, so you'd have this, you would throw up, and it would be clinging to your face, and you would suffocate and die. So, of course, I looked into this because that's what I do. And they called one of the suit technicians. He's like, are you kidding me? Do you think we haven't thought this through? There's 24 channels in a spacesuit, and there's two major air channels that are blowing down over the face, so the material would be blown into the body of the suit. I'm like, ew. Okay, not fatal, but gross. But he said, well, the only possible lethal scenario would be that you'd have visor splatter, which could be if you're out in space and you're trying to keep your orientation and, you know, you're going 17,000 miles per hour and holding on to the outside of a spacecraft, you don't want to be blinded by your own vomit. So that could be a problem. And that actually was a problem, not with vomit, but Charlie Duke, I love Charlie Duke, when he was on the moon, he had a situation where the astronauts, when they're wearing the pressure suits, there's a drink bag. It's kind of like a camelback where you've got the little tube and you bite down on it and the fluid comes into your mouth. Well, Charlie Duke had a Tang leakage situation. So it's leaking and he's literally got like Tang all through his hair. It's like droplets are floating around. This, can you imagine the pinnacle of your career, of your life? You're walking on the moon. And there's Tang everywhere. He's got this line, this wonderful line. He's like out on the, he's walking around. Or maybe he's in the rover. I forget which mission it is, if rover or wasn't rover. But there's these craters called Wreck and Trap. I'm not sure why they're called that. But at one point, Charlie Duke says, yeah, I can see Wreck and Trap and orange juice. But anyway, the other thing going on, if you were to vomit in a helmet, you have what's called a cough reflex. If you inhaled whatever it is, vomit, pond water, I don't care, you inhale it, you have a reflex to cough. You wouldn't drown in your own vomit, which was sort of the rumor that went around. So go ahead and vomit in your helmets. I think I'd like to turn it over to. We could talk about. Well, maybe we should talk about sex in space. Should we talk about sex in space? I really did try to track down. I try to find somebody. You know, there's a lot of rumors. There's tons of rumors about sex in space, and most of them are absurd. Like the one that claimed that NASA used taxpayer dollars in the neutral buoyancy tank. This is this huge swimming pool where they rehearse their moves on the outside of the space station, because you float in water. It's similar to floating in space. You put on your suit and you rehearse all the things you're going to do on a submerged mock-up. And there was a rumor that they had put had astronauts in the neutral buoyancy tank testing different sexual positions in zero gravity. So stupid. First of all, taxpayer dollars, I don't think so. Also, you could do this in a swimming pool. Why would you need the neutral buoyancy tank? But this made the rounds on the internet. Anyway, I wanted to interview. I wasn't so much interested in somebody who'd had sex, you know, at 62 miles or higher in space. I was interested in somebody who'd had sex in zero gravity while floating. And there are those flights, as I mentioned before, you know, the zero gravity plane. And I thought, all I need is somebody who's done it on a zero gravity. Then I can say, like, is it better or worse? You know, because you're kind of bouncing apart. I think gravity is your friend when it comes to sex. But I wanted to interview someone, and I found supposedly there was this porn film called The Uranus Experiments that claimed to have a scene shot in zero gravity on one of these planes. And the star was Sylvia Saint, and I have some contacts who worked in the porn, and I tried every avenue. Sylvia Saint retired. She went back to the Czech Republic. I couldn't track her down, but I called the production company, and they're in Spain, and I said, I got the president of the company. I said, so you actually rented a zero, you got, how did you, he said, well, you know, we have a timeshare. Yeah, I have a timeshare with a private jet company, and we did it that way. I said, you got a private jet pilot to fly parabolic, really? He said, yeah, we did that. And I said, wow, that's kind of amazing. And I said, he said, I'll send you the download. So he sent me that. It's actually a three-part series, Uranus Experiments 1, Uranus Experiments 2, 3. So I got these downloads, and it's actually a very entertaining porn film. There's one part I love when the astronauts are having this massive orgy, and somehow somebody flips on the cameras, and so Mission Control is seeing this huge, you know, screen of the orgy going on. And having been to Mission Control and Johnson Space Center, you just really want that kind of thing to happen and really shake them up. But, okay, they claim, in the press release, they say, all right, the zero-gravity sex scene, it's at the end of, it's in part three. And I went, and I was like, all right. You get to the scene. I'm like, okay, this is it. Sylvia Saint's ponytail, okay, it's hanging down her back. Her breasts don't have that lovely buoyancy that they would have. It's just completely faked. It was completely faked. They were basically standing behind like a console like this, kind of going. That was the zero gravity shot. And then for the money shot, they sort of just flipped it over so it looked like he was floating. It was so lame. And I spent a lot of time tracking that down. Anyway, sex in space, yeah. I did have a couple of cosmonauts, the Alexander Levakin, the wonderful man who talked about the hanging yourself in zero gravity. I asked him about this. I said, you were 6 months. Okay, 6 months, two guys in space. You know, you're a healthy young man. What, this is an awkward thing, right? He goes, yeah, my friends, they're asking me. It's like, Sasha, how are you making sex in space? He says, of course, by hand. I mean, it was just like, duh, you know. But try to get NASA to talk about that, you know. It's just, there was one of the Apollo flight surgeons who actually said, who wanted to make it a formal recommendation that masturbation be employed as a way to prevent prostate infections. Like, he put that out there, and then just everyone in NASA was like, I don't know who said that. Nobody said it. Just ignore it. So it's just been this, like, we don't talk about that. But in Moscow, this was the most amazing. He said, you know, IBMP, that's the Institute of Biomedical Problems, and they're the people that deal with all the physiological stuff for the Russian Space Agency. IBMP, and I'd read this elsewhere and thought, that is made up. There's no way. But he told me this was true. He said IBMP, actually, they thought about, should we send up, you know, he put it, a mock-up. I said, what do you mean? He said, a rubber woman, an inflatable doll. I loved it. He called it a mock-up. and he said, but flight control said to us, Now, you can't do that because if you do that, we have to build it into your schedule and we're not going to bother. So, I don't know, it's just, anyway, it's a fascinating topic and it just cracks me up how uncomfortable NASA is with it, most of NASA. I'd like to turn it over to... How did I go about picking the topics that I cover? They seem like they're kind of a hodgepodge that have nothing to do with each other, but they're really all about the human body in unusual circumstances, which just is something that fascinates me, I guess. It's just where my curiosity takes me. Knowing what I now know, would I go into space or to Mars? Which one? Absolutely. Sign me up for a round trip to the moon. 2 weeks, I would love to. I'm the kind of person, I've always been drawn to those empty spots on the map. You know, like, whoa, what's there? There's no one down there. What's it like? So few people have been there. Of course, you get there, and you quickly realize why nobody's there. Because it's cold and inhospitable, and there's nothing there, and no one would want to live there. But to walk on the moon, I would love to. Mars, no freaking way. 3 years round trip. No, I can't be in a little space. I mean, I'm not the right personality. I don't know who is, you know, trying to choose someone for a Mars mission. For Mercury, you know, it was a completely different Mercury versus the space shuttle era. These are totally different people. Mercury was like, you know, John Glenn, Gus Grissom, Chuck Yeager type people, you know, brave, virile, huge ego, aggressive, fearless. I'm going to go there. I can do it. I don't care. Macho. Okay, that's the last person you want. Five of those people in a room. That's bad news. So now the modern astronaut, the NASA recommended astronaut attributes. The list is kind of amazing. It's like flexibility, sense of humor, fairness, empathy, ability to form stable and quality interpersonal relationships. Really, it's like, you know, sensitive new age guy. And for Mars, you're going to need a combination of the old Gus Grissom and the new age guy. And I don't know where you find those people. They're going to be extraordinary. Plus, they'll have to be like MacGyver. You know, they got to be able to do everything. You know, jack of all trades. I don't want to go to Mars. I want to see it. I want to be watching it on TV, but no, not for me. The question was on a Mars mission, a long-term mission. Wouldn't you be better off without an appendix? That's a really great observation, and I spoke to a woman at NASA who said that she had been there at meetings back when they were, you know, more actively discussing Mars, and they talked about how they would do prophylactic surgery, meaning they would remove appendix. They were actually talking about ovaries in women, whatever you could do without. I mean, I don't think they're going to take an extra kidney, you know, like leave you with one kidney. But yeah, you try to prevent or head off as many problems as you can before you go. Yeah, tremendous medical issues. And with a 20-minute communication lie, like hello. We have a medical emergency. Okay, wait 20 minutes for the reply. So you've really got to be able to deal with it yourselves. So yes, the question was, well, it has to do with the famous incident with Lisa Nowak, who was in love with a man who was now involved with someone else, Colleen Shipman, and she drove down to meet her love rival at the airport. Of course, what everybody is familiar with was the fact that she was wearing a diaper, which, you know, if you're trying to get somewhere really quickly and you're driving in a car and you've been trained as an astronaut, that's what you would do. Because you don't have to stop. I mean, it just made perfect sense to me. And the thing, and then she, her explanation, and I know you didn't ask about the diaper thing, but her explanation, she goes, no, I wasn't wearing those. Those were diapers that we'd had in the car after the last hurricane and we had an emergency. That's why those used diapers. I mean, I'm thinking, that's a better thing that you left used diapers in your car for 12, however many years since the last, anyway. But yeah, no, NASA was very uncomfortable for them. And as soon as it happened, like the next day they announced, we are going to revisit all of our astronaut psychological screening practices, because obviously we're missing some things. But it just speaks to the tremendous amount of stress. It's an incredibly stressful job. I mean, you have no private life. You know, you are always, you know, whatever you say, you are a spokesperson for the space agency. It is tremendously difficult, and I'm surprised there aren't more breakdowns like that. Yeah, I don't know if that was the, yeah. Yeah, and I didn't really write, I have a footnote about it. I didn't want to really try to drag this woman through that again. But I felt bad for her. The radiation problem, yes, bingo. Radiation is the biggest issue for a Mars mission where you are going beyond the protection of, we're protected, the atmosphere protects us from solar radiation, we've got the magnetic field. You go out into space, you've got none of that. You are bombarded by cosmic radiation, these heavy, incredibly fast-moving particles that blast right through the metal of your capsule and cause mutations and are... there isn't an answer right now. There is, well, we could, you know, maybe we would, you know, if the moon base, they're talking about using this planet itself as shielding, digging down below, and in the case of a solar storm, you'd go underground, but there isn't a good answer. The solution would be to send, for a Mars mission, you would probably be sending people in their 60s, because you get a mutation from that kind of radiation, it's like 10 or 20 years before the cancer develops, and they're at the end of their lifetime anyway. So they're basically saying, there's nothing we could do about it. There's kind of an expectation that, well, we'll figure something out, and I'm not sure that they will. And I would say that is the biggest problem, hurdle for a Mars mission is radiation. No, I don't think the Chinese are as far ahead as people think they are. There's sort of this like, oh, the Chinese are going to get to the moon now that we're not going. Oh, the Chinese are going to get to Mars. But the Chinese haven't gotten very far yet. So I don't think the Chinese are going to get there anytime soon. I don't think the U.S. is going to get there anytime soon. And whether, you know, maybe it's going to be some, I think it should be some sort of global cooperative thing where everybody sort of gets together and, you know, pitches in with funding and expertise and technology and private. I think it'll be a private venture before it's any sort of government agency. But you know, when we were going to be on track for Mars, what was it, 2035? So now, 2040 would be optimistic. And it's sad. I'd love to see it. Although it is an incredibly dangerous and foolhardy thing to do. It would be really exciting. The question was, why do we want to go to Mars as a human being? I think the same reason we, cross oceans and the same reason, like, I want to go down to Antarctica, I think there's just this desire to explore. I think it's just in the genes to want to find out what's out there and just go there. And I think that's the most basic answer for it. You know, you could talk about, well, at a certain point, the sun will stop keeping us warm, and we'll need to, as a species, move on. But I'm not even. That's just so far in the future that I can't even contemplate that. I just think it's this human need to go places we haven't gone, to keep pushing out there. That's, I guess, why we do it. I spent some time at the JAXA, which is the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, and that was fascinating. They were doing they were choosing a new astronaut, and they had the 10 finalists, and they had them in an isolation chamber being observed by psychologists and psychiatrists for a week. I mean, a much bigger emphasis on the psychological. I mean, NASA doesn't do that. They've got, they fill out a lot of those sort of questionnaires, and they talk to a psychiatrist, but they don't do anything like this. There was this elaborate, and they would come up with these scenarios and observe how they behaved. And the first day I was there, they did. They passed out these envelopes to the 10 finalists, and they opened them up, and there's these colored paper. It was an origami test. It was called 1,000 Cranes, and each astronaut candidate or applicant had to do 100 cranes, and they would be strung on a string and given to a psychologist who would then evaluate and look at. How does the last crane compare to the first? Was there accuracy? Did they keep their focus? Were they sloppy? And really, because space, there's a lot of tedium and repetition in the modern space era. It's not this sort of brave heroics. You're not usually dealing with a catastrophic emergency. You're doing something repetitive. And so it was really a kind of a brilliant little test, although, I mean, trying to picture John Glenn, like folding origami cranes. It was just 180 degrees different from sort of the classic astronaut selection. But they, and I talked to the flight surgeon there about that. I said, well, it seems like Japanese people would be pretty well suited, you know, because they tend to, you know, keep their emotions in check. They're very conscious of, you know, how, getting along with other people. And he said, actually, too much of that. The depressive tendencies would come in. He said, fortunately, they train with American astronauts and they become more like American astronauts. So they sort of find a balance. But just a completely different feeling and approach. Of course, they're obviously training for the same sorts of things that they'll, because they'd be training, they'd be on the same spacecraft, the International Space Station. But not, but the just a, couldn't be more different. Yeah. I don't know about the Chinese Space Agency because nobody gets into this Chinese Space Agency, certainly not me. You know, I had this naive thing like, I'll just show up on the doorstep and they'll say, come on in. And I contacted somebody who actually works with them. I said, are you kidding me? Don't even bother. You will not, you'll get, if you ever get an interview, it'll just be like sitting down and hearing a generic, they won't tell you anything. So I didn't go to China. I would have loved to. The question was, there was a myth that if you're on a Mars mission and they ran, started running low on, if you were sick? Oh, that they would just eject you. I can't imagine that because the PR, the bad PR that you would, no, I really don't think, although I found an interesting, when I worked on STIF, this isn't really, to answer your question, I never heard that before. And it would be hard to imagine NASA embracing such a PR disaster. But the issue of what to do if somebody dies on a Mars mission, that came up. One of the people I interviewed in STIF was a woman in Sweden, an ecologist who came up with a human composting technique where you would deep freeze the body and then use vibration to break it into small pieces, sort of freeze dry like Sanka, like the little pieces. And then this would be used as compost to plant a plant. Okay, they came up with NASA, working with NASA for a technique that would, you'd put the body, if somebody died on a Mars mission, the obvious thing, you'd put them in the airlock and give them a burial in space, like a burial at sea. But the thinking was the family would want the remains, and so how do you deal with that? Well, you would put it in the airlock and freeze it, and then they had this paw, this arm would, like robotic arm, would pull it out and like shake, do the vibration, and then they had sort of a technique to take the moisture out of the cremains, and then they'd bring it back in. So, they'd just sort of pull it along for the whole mission, and then when they re-entered, they'd have to bring it back in because it would burn up otherwise. It would be like cremated on top of composted. So they'd bring it back in this little pod. It was like this 20-page PowerPoint that they'd worked out and NASA, with NASA. So they have given some thought to what do you do with a body on a mission? You know, you can't just have it sitting around in the capsule. You've got to, have it in the airlock. Well, it's a little weird for the whole duration of the mission. So anyway, but it's an interesting challenge. But that I never heard, that you would essentially like the Eskimos putting the old people out on the ice floe and pushing them away. No, maybe there's a protocol, but nobody told me about it. Spook was really a book about. It was a book about people trying to use science to prove or disprove that there's a soul or an afterlife. So I was really, I knew that I wasn't going to find the answer to this, you know, the mystery of the millennia, like what happens when we die. So I didn't really, if I had to put my money on it, somebody forced me. My general feeling is, it's kind of arrogant to say that you know one way or the other. I don't know. I honestly don't know if there is or isn't. You know, science is not very good at coming up with any kind of proof or evidence, but it may be something that is beyond our capability for understanding and for devising a technique to pin it down. So, but it's a really interesting world, those people who've tried to use laboratory science, the scientific method to address something that is in the realm of the spiritual or the religious. So, the question was the composting, the ecological burial technique of composting. How is the business doing? They've started in Korea of all places. They've got the technique is up and running in Sweden. They are now. It's taken a while. It's been 10 years. But finally, there is someone who has essentially the franchise to come and do it here in the U.S. So I think you will be probably in California, So it is. She's very much involved with it, and it's happening now. It's been very taken her a long time. She's a very committed woman, lovely woman. So coming soon to a neighborhood near you, human body composting. You can create the vacuum of space here on Earth using a vacuum chamber. You pump the air out, and you have a vacuum. And you can see what happens to, you know, unfortunately, the studies done in the 60s were using animals. And you have more time than you would think. An astronaut who, say there's a leak in the spacesuit, they thought, initially the thinking was he will explode. He will just like balloon up and instantly die. But you have about 3 minutes, I think it is. I mean, it's in the book, and it's been a while since I've looked at it. But you've got more time than you would think to get. I mean, if you have an oxygen supply, I mean, if you suddenly, the thing that would kill you first is the fact that there's no oxygen. So if you have an oxygen supply, the pressure itself, the fact that there's no pressure on you, you would have a matter of minutes. But it's not instantaneous like they used to think. Oh, well, yeah, temperature. Along with oxygen, you would need some sort of, I'm assuming you'd have some sort of heat. Because otherwise you just, you'd freeze as quickly as you'd freeze in a... I'm just talking about the vacuum side of it, the aspect of it. The temperature, I don't know how long you would have for that. I mean, there's like the temperature, the lack of oxygen, and the lack of air pressure. There's three things that you're going to kill you. But you have to kind of look at them one at a time. But if you had a spacesuit that was keeping you warm and giving you oxygen, but it was not pressurizing anymore... If it wasn't pressurized, then you would have, I think it was 3 minutes to get back in. Not a lot of time, but more than people had thought. Yeah. The question was, schedules are pretty regimented in space, and how are people enjoying themselves? And it's one extreme or the other. If you're on a two-week shuttle mission, you are way overscheduled. You've got so many studies that you've got to do. And they never build in time for, like, the whatever the device is that I'm using, I let it go and it drifted off and it took me 25 minutes to find it. I mean, that kind of thing, just the zero gravity just makes everything, it just slows you down, and they don't build that into it, so people get behind really quickly. So, and it's so regimented. I mean, NASA TV, you watch NASA TV and it'll say, the astronauts will be entering the pre-sleep phase at 10:57 p.m. and the sleep phase at 11:57 p.m., awaking 8 hours later on the minute. Well, who lives like that? You know what I mean? So they're taking sleeping pills for sure. They're sleep deprived and they've got way too much to do. On the other extreme, on the International Space Station, tedium and boredom. I mean, you're up there for 6 months and you often don't have enough to fill your time, and there's not a lot of options for recreation. You can't go and play tennis. You can't go for a run. You can't go shopping. You can't drink. I mean, stress relief and boredom relief are hard to come by, so that stuff. People bring musical instruments, books. You know, the e-reader, it hasn't been approved yet. The Kindle has not yet been approved. It has to go through this whole sniff test and off-gassing test, and it hasn't yet been approved for space. But I'm sure they'll be bringing up. ISS has a library. They do have books up there, but not a lot of options. Exercise, they do have a lot of exercising up there. But so you either have one or the other. You either have no free time, and you're overworked, or you have too much. Gene Cernan on the way to the moon, I'll leave you with this last quote. This is unbelievable. Apollo 17, the man is going to the moon. The quote in his memoir, funny thing happened on the way to the moon. Not much. Should have brought some crossword puzzles. Anyway, that's space. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.